Hi everyone, this is Jason McIntosh with a quick preamble before this episode. I wanted to acknowledge the gap of several months in between the release dates of the previous episode and this one. I have a confession to make. After we recorded this episode in July, I sort of lost my head and decided to publish a tablet game of my own. So I did, and unsurprisingly, this took up all my spare time for a while. But it's done now. It's called Sixis, that's spelled S-I-X-I-S, and it's a dice game designed by my friend Chris Seslick of Osmodi Games. You can find it in the iPad App Store. As for the show, I'm pleased to report that it's free of dated references except for a spot or two where I refer to things as happening later this year, and from your own modern perspective, they've already happened. But we're back on track to finish out our first season of 6 episodes, the next one of which will take much less time to air. Thanks for your patience and enjoy the show.
What were you playing recently that made you want to talk about this?
Well, okay, Hero Academy, which is a game published by Robot Entertainment. It's currently available on iOS, and it's coming out on a PC via Steam later this year. Yes, so I've been playing this game on the iPad. It's essentially a strictly two-player, turn-based strategic game where each side has essentially a deck or a bag of pieces that are themed around, you know, Western fantasy tropes. So the starter team that you get has, you know, mages and rangers and clerics and so on. And you play them on a board, and they all have standard movement and attack patterns, and the object is to either knock out all your opponent's pieces or destroy these vulnerable crystals. If you can do either of those, you win the game. There are several reasons why I have just become so enamored with this, but I think the core of all of these is that it's been a while since I've had a digital multiplayer experience that has really reminded me what I love so much about playing with humans versus playing against an entirely scripted, pre-designed environment. And by entirely scripted, I don't mean that necessarily in the sense of a film script. I mean, I include, you know, procedural content and that sort of thing. The video games that we've been talking about are single-player experiences which involve a designer or team of designers who build a machine, who map out a space that you, their audience, the player, explore in order to have a story be told to you or, you know, in the more general sense, ideas be passed from the creator to the audience. Where in a multiplayer game, it's very often the other party that you're communicating with in a multiplayer game is usually not the designer of the experience, not the designer of this sculpture, this space that you're exploring, but it's usually other people. And they are not acting according to a script. They're not acting according to unfolding AI routines. They're usually very surprising. And to me, even digitally, even on only network play, even on only network asynchronous play where the turns might be days apart from each other, the experience with playing with other people is so much more basically rewarding, I find. Does that sound fair?
Absolutely, yes. no, it's unfair. I maintain that you cannot say that.
I'm just checking that I'm making sense so far.
Versus... Oh, yes. Well, it's certain. Oh, you mean like fair in the sense of clarity, not in the moral sense.
well, I mean, tell me if I'm getting into gray moral territory as well here.
Well, it's sort of gray moral territory because, I mean, well, first of all, of course it's fair. I mean, it's not gray moral territory, but what it is it's certainly a contested territory. It's a controversial territory because since the sort of rise of video games as this cultural phenomenon, there's been this kind of undercurrent, there's been a reaction from certain people within the community of video gamers and also outside the community of a kind of like a, hey, we were here first, and, you know, what is a game? What is not a game? Like, are you really into, you say you're into games, you say you're a quote-unquote gamer, but you really only like video games, and you know, if you, or you only normally play those, and if you weren't, if you really liked games, you would sort of love them apart from their digital versions. And so it's a contested territory that I don't know if we necessarily want to get into that right now. I think we should get into that at some point in the podcast, but I just wanted to bring it up because one of the reasons why the digital version of a non-digital game that retains its non-digital tropes on purpose is such an interesting thing to talk about is partially because of this strange tension between the culture of video games and the culture of non-digital games. I mean, obviously that already has overlap in terms of sports. I mean, there's quite a lot of digital sports games. It's interesting because I think that, you know, you kind of have a wider palette than I do in terms of straddling the digital non-digital divide. And I am definitely coming more from the world of video games, just culturally speaking. I mean, I did not grow up playing non-digital games, and it was not something that was really part of me or my friends or any of those things. And it's more something that I've kind of come to out of, partially out of guilt, as I've gotten into, I mean, to be perfectly honest, like I feel like I didn't get a job once because I actually told somebody in a job interview I didn't like Settlers of Catan. and I know that, I mean, I don't think that was the only reason, but it was like one of these big kind of like culture shock moments where I know people who are just like, if you don't think that game is great or if you don't like it, you actually must be stupid. And how could anybody know anything about games and not see the genius of that game?
Now, did you say you didn't like it or that you didn't know anything about it?
I said I didn't like playing it.
No, that's just stupid.
Well.
But I mean, were you able to defend the fact about why you didn't like it, or is that?
Well, I think so. Well, I don't remember it very clearly, but I think that it wasn't just like, do you like this game? And I said no. Like it wasn't the exchange.
Get out.
Well, it's one of those things where I think like sort of liking something and appreciating something are, there's kind of a fine line between those things. And so I think really where I'm going with this is board games, digital versions of board games, or when video games kind of maintain this kind of board game artifice as part of what they are. I mean, it's an interesting design space, but it's also an interesting cultural space because it's drawing attention to a collision of these two worlds that to some gamers don't feel like two worlds, but in some other ways are very different worlds. Over the years, I have played some games that are like that, but I almost feel like I would actually sooner play a digital version of a board game than an actual board game. And I'm not sure why that is. I don't know if it's just like I like interacting with other people, but I don't get excited about playing board games the same way a lot of people I know do. And I haven't actually fully investigated why that is. And you were just saying just now that you find the interaction with other human beings versus just interacting with a system a kind of superior experience, at least in a certain way. And you were kind of asking me if that was fair. I'm just wondering, is that what you were kind of thinking when you were saying, is that fair? Is it fair to say that is superior because it's another person, and therefore multiplayer games are kind of getting at something closer to the heart of games than games where you're just facing off against a system, which is something that computer games actually make a lot easier to produce because of the fact that the system is automated. It's a computer. Therefore, it has given rise to this huge kind of phenomenon of these kind of automated game systems where you're just fighting the system. Do you see where I'm getting at?
Yeah, I don't consider a game that's played against another human to be a naturally superior experience than a solitaire game where the player is just within a single system. It's just enough of a different experience that between that and stuff I see every day, you know, on Twitter and other sources, the sorts of games that are represented by wholly multiplayer experiences and the sorts of games that are represented by primarily single player experiences seem to be like entirely different universes.
Oh, I see.
They sometimes seem, I mean, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but it's something I don't necessarily see addressed a lot. And whenever any given subgroup within people who like games or study games or make games or just play them use the word game, they usually have one specific sub-definition of game in mind.
Yes. And yes, 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 definitely.
That's not incorrect because yet context is a important feature of most any human language, but it just seems especially pronounced when we're talking about games. I was reminded of this today, and I'll link to this in the show notes. I'll just see if I can pull it up really quickly.
That as you're pulling that up, that reminds me of I don't know why I always bring this up all the time. People who know me are probably tired of it, but do you remember the Blues Brothers, the movie?
I have seen that film.
Well, there was a part in the movie where they go into a bar in a rural area, and they're this blues band that goes into this bar, like totally out of their element. And they ask this woman at the bar, they say, "Do you have live music here?" And she says, "Yes." And they say, "What type?" And she says, "We have both kinds, country and Western."
Oh, that's where that's from.
Oh, is it from that? Or is it from something else? And it was just used in the Blues Brothers.
No, it's probably from that. I've heard that joke before.
Okay. So like, but it's funny that kind of like, myopic view of culture is all over games and video games and anything that's kind of like related. And some people, I think, understand that there's a whole bunch of different subcultures. And when they say games, they understand it's about context. But you do actually run into people who seem kind of hilariously unaware that there are games that are kind of outside their sort of immediate definition of games. So this is a very kind of complicated, sticky topic. Because there is a lot of awareness about it, but there is a lot of kind of interesting insulation about it. I definitely know people who were like shocked that I was not into games outside video games. And then I know other people who it would never even occur to them why I would be. And I've met plenty of both of those kinds of people.
The reason I'll get back to the thing I was looking at, but I mean, as far as if I can get into your backstory here, my sort of assumption as to why you are primarily interested in narrative in games is because you're coming at this as a film student.
Yeah, it is weird. It wasn't like I went to film school and then kind of like decided that I wanted to do games. I mean, I was always kind of into games and movies growing up, and I liked plenty of games that were not narrative. It's not that I don't like or can't appreciate non-narrative games or multiplayer games or games that are about strategy or more about like reading other humans, human behavior and kind of like strategizing against them or whatever. You can enjoy a wide range of things, but then when it comes time to the thing you actually want to put effort into making, like what you enjoy and what you create aren't necessarily the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think that because I'm so interested in storytelling, if I'm going to spend time making a game, I think I'm interested in trying to crack this nut. Which is the kind of narrative nut, which is like the nut, the difficult kind of nut to crack. That doesn't mean that's kind of my only avenue into video games. Well, there I go again, video games. Is that my only avenue into games? And I think that the kind of like not being that into non-digital games doesn't so much have to do with narrative, I think, or being interested in narrative games. I think it has more to do with that actually not being part of the culture I grew up in. Because if you're getting together with your friends and playing board games all the time your whole life, I mean, I know people who played D&D with their parents from when they were like 6 years old or when they were like, 8 years old or something. That is not what happened. That was not my life. And I didn't know anybody who did that.
My parents bought me the D&D basic set, but their relationship with the game stopped there. I think I once played Dungeon! With my mom and dad. My mom was a wizard.
To put this in perspective, my parents actually believed that demons would take over my body if I played Dungeons and Dragons.
They saw that Tom Hanks movie, didn't they?
They were. I'm not joking at all. I mean, my parents were like, I remember a Focus on the Family, which is the Dr. James Dobson, and Dr. James Dobson, for people who don't know, are like he's the grand figurehead of this like vast kind of like Christian media empire.
I think the technical term is ancient worm with a Y. Continue.
Okay. He is something astonishingly powerful, at the center of this kind of like vast, sort of like media network that's basically just like an extended kind of church, basically. But anyway, he had this magazine called Focus on the Family that my parents subscribed to. And I remember one issue of it, which was a guy who had killed his parents and was in jail, and he blamed it on Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
And it was like a whole interview. So that was like my only exposure to Dungeons and Dragons when I was a kid, that and the Saturday morning cartoon show. So I had a very confused idea as to what this was all about. I thought it was this very silly thing on television, or it was this thing that could actually enter into your soul and, I don't know, destroy your mind somehow. As I grew up, I never met anybody who was really that into it either, which is strange. There's kind of a legitimate cultural question going on here. It's almost just like, it's almost like a sensibility. If being into board games is like America, I feel like I'm Canadian. Like, I feel like I'm similar but different in a way that everybody kind of sees but nobody quite understands and nobody really minds.
And everybody makes jokes about how polite you video gamers are.
And everybody makes jokes that are not derogatory at all.
Something poutine.
But nobody can quite shrug off the difference because there is a difference.
I mean, my own background wasn't really steeped in board games either. I only came to board games as an adult, actually, after basically an entire lifetime playing only single player video games because I was a lonely nerd.
That's what it was like for me.
There you go. I've only come to really appreciate what multiplayer video games in particular can do and accomplish, and how experientially different they are from a quote unquote normal single player game experience. I'm going to remove the word normal. That makes no sense.
Oh, that's loaded language there.
I know, right? Well, as I was thinking, what do we think about when we think of video games? And, you know, but there's this giant community of people who only play multiplayer Halo or multiplayer Madden, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Communities.
And those exist within video games.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. In 1991, I logged into a MUD for the first time, right?
Hmm.
And the day I did this, and this was in October of 1991, and I was a freshman in college, I never knew boredom again. And for a few years, that was a directly causal relationship because I was addicted to MUDs and I would play on MUDs all day long. Those are only barely games. Like the first ones I played were actually multiplayer D&D simulations where you would wander around a Zork style map with text commands and you would slay kobolds and you could say hi to people. It was a text-based MMO, really. Literally.
It was kind of like a combat chat room.
Yeah.
A little bit, right?
It was more like, it really is analogous to World of Warcraft, where you have a character with stats, and you're in a world, and you can move around, and there's areas, and monsters will spawn automatically, and you fight them, and, you know, you can run into other characters and team up with them, and whatever.
Oh, okay.
It's the exact same idea. It was just done literally two decades before. Yeah, it was all text. It was all, you know, Infocom informed. Interface. I continued to play MUDs and their derivative games for many years after that, but they were all, at that point, it really was chat rooms, not so much combat chat rooms, but chat rooms with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was more like Minecraft, actually, but that's really stretching it, because Minecraft is a beautiful procedural machine where you can make very specific structures out of very discrete materials, and the games I played, these had no monsters to kill, but you could create areas and script them. It was more like Second Life, really.
Yeah, so they were more sandboxy.
Yeah, yeah. You weren't really playing a game with other people. There was just a digital environment where you could sometimes be creative with these toys that were given to you, but you spent 95% of your time socializing. And I bring all that up to say that was my first exposure to digital multiplayer games, and that had a profound effect on me, and I really wanted to play games online for years after that, and it really, for me, hasn't come into fruition until very recently with the ascendance of mobile technology and tablet technology, which is really, I'm kind of getting off track. Where I was going to say is the tablets are really melding together digital and tabletop environments in an interesting way, but I wasn't necessarily talking about tabletop. But do you see where I'm getting at? In that the technology is in the pervasive access to high-speed internet, and as you know, as game producers get better at making games and figure out how to make good multiplayer experiences, I'm finally starting to see the games that I wanted to play years and years ago. Hero Academy is one of the first that's gotten me really excited.
Can you concisely sort of summarize why you think that is? Like what is the breakthrough? Even if it's not a breakthrough for other people, why is that a breakthrough for you?
About this particular game?
Yeah, why is this particular game a breakthrough for you? Like, why is this game, why does this game excite you in ways that other games don't? Or, like, how does this achieve those things from the past but achieve them now and in a way that satisfies you in a way you haven't been satisfied in so long?
Yeah, well, it succeeds on a few different levels. First of all, and this is at the surface level, it is a really highly polished experience. There's nothing rough around the edges. It's a beautiful piece of software. It's really fun to use. I have to imagine that a lot of kids play this, which is awesome. The entire user experience is simple and brilliant, and it avoids so many mistakes and pitfalls that I see in not just tabletop style multiplayer digital, but a lot of different kinds of online multiplayer games. It just says, we're not going to do any of that stuff. It has no lobby. It has no chat system, except for a very simple one when you're actually playing. The way you start a game is you launch it and you say, unless you happen to know somebody's username, if you have a friend you want to play with, you hit a button that says, start a game. And the game will pair you up with somebody in about a minute. And then you're playing. And it has no AI, which was weird to me at first, but I very quickly came to accept it that, no, they made this game so that you would play it against other people, and they removed all of the roadblocks to finding people to play with, unlike so many other games, in part because it's on a very popular platform, and in part because this is a separate topic, the way they leverage the, I hate to use the word, but I think it's the best one to describe it, the free-to-play commercial model is so good, so non-evil, which I can talk about, that there's always an audience for people to play with.
So it sounds like you're saying that it's a true board game in a way, like using the digital technology to allow you to play with other players. Because quite a lot of multiplayer games over the past, 15, 20 years, or more like 15, I guess, have involved a lot of elements that are very automated, very similar to single player games. And it sounds like what you're saying is this really is a game that is almost like a pure board game. It's just in the digital medium, and it has such a level of confidence about that that it is able to streamline everything that's good about a board game experience into the digital realm, which it sounds like you haven't quite experienced before that well.
Right. It is really a celebration of what you can do once a tabletop game goes digital. And I'm not meaning to imply that a adaptation or an addition of a real, like an actual board game, cannot do this, that it has to be native. In this case, it does happen to be a native to digital game. You cannot go by Hero Academy by Milton Bradley in a box. It exists only in this electronic format.
I see.
Oh, did you not know that?
No, I didn't. Well, no, I didn't know that. But you're just saying it's kind of irrelevant, right? That, I mean, if it was a board game, it would be the same, or it would just be.
Well, I think the fact that they got to define what this game was without having to be held back by an earlier edition that only existed in the physical world.
Oh, I see. In other words, they got to take everything that they thought was great about board games that they thought also would work and were not on a digital space, and they weren't burdened with feeling like they had to include anything that might not work because fans were expecting it.
Yeah. I mean, not to read their minds here, but as a player who's played several dozen games of this over the past few months, that's definitely what I've picked up on. And also as somebody who has not just played digital adaptations of physical board games, but who tried to launch a startup a few years ago that was based on making digital adaptations of board games and seeing firsthand how hard that is. And I think the one example of the actual gameplay of Hero Academy where they say, no, actually there's two examples where the fact that it started out digitally and they just take it forward from there. And by God, I wish more turn-based electronic games did this. In the case of Hero Academy, so to really boil down the rules, on your turn, you have five actions, right? You can make five actions. An action is you can play a piece from you have a Scrabble-style rack of heroes and equipment and spells that you can play onto the board. At the end of your turn, you refill your board up back to six pieces from a bag, essentially. You can also move a piece you already have on the board, or you can attack with a piece. And each of those counts as a single action, and you have five of those on your turn. Because the game is asynchronous, unlike a lot of other iPad games I've been seeing, and we're getting a little specific to like my gripes about iPad and or digital games in particular, but you know,
that's fine.
Something that I bet they thought about, because other games did this and they decided, no, we're not going to do this. There is no indicator if your opponent happens to be sitting at their iPad or later at their PC staring at the screen. It is meant to be played purely asynchronously. There's no pressure. There's no visual or otherwise pressure to take your turn quickly. And there is a control that lets you rewind your turn. Also, every move is deterministic. There's no dice being rolled. Add all these together, and you can take all the time you want playing out five actions, seeing what happens, rewinding, spending your five actions some other way, rewinding, until you finally have spent your turn the way you want to, and only then you hit the submit button, and then your move gets sent to the server, and then it's the other player's turn.
So it's more like, it sounds like it's, when you say it's back to tabletop, a lot of that sounds like chess. Like it sounds like the asynchronicity of it seems more like chess. I mean, the way you can play chess with somebody, you know, over the phone, just in terms of like having no pressure.
Yeah, I often think of
thinking of the strategy, because it really is about, it's all about the move. And it's all about strategy and thinking ahead of your opponent. And there's absolutely nothing about the game to take you away from that.
It's essentially play by mail, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, but that sounds, I mean, it's funny too, the way that goes against conventional wisdom, because it's often like, because the technology allows for X, or because the technology can do X, there's not a lot of thought of, well, limiting information to, siloing information to kind of like one, you know, one dimension can really focus things and actually accentuate the kind of, they can focus the experience on exactly the right kind of pleasure point. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. It's kind of funny. I mean, I think that I say this about video phones. So, I mean, there's a reason that I'm Skyping, you know, right now without visuals. Because I'm just kind of like, bleh. I'm like dead and it's hot and everything. I love how in science fiction movies, like everybody assumes that, well, you know, of course there's going to be video phones, and, you know, because who wouldn't want to look at who they're speaking to? But, you know, I mean, we have the ability for that technology now, but I mean, nobody actually, I mean, there's a value to limiting the information. And I think that, you know, because technology is so amazing now, it's like you can have something that tells you when the other player is there, and you can have this, and you can have that, and you can have all these things. But there's something very simple about just saying no to like 90% of that. It doesn't make the game more, it doesn't it's funny too, because it doesn't, it's not limiting the game, it's focusing the game. It's
right,
focusing
exactly.
the game on exactly what you want it to be about.
Yep.
And that seems, but when we talk about kind of like games kind of coming into their own in terms of this ultra advanced technology that we have now, it sounds like what you're, it sounds like if I interpret what you're saying that 20 years ago you were playing these games that were really interesting, and the, in some ways, the problem with technology now is that it's too advanced. It's so advanced it confuses people. And there's something about the simplicity of what a board games traditionally have achieved that is also achievable in the digital medium, but you have to understand how to use the digital medium and not get carried away with it.
I think that, well, the core of what you're saying, yeah, is about focus, and I think that applies to any kind of, well, any kind of design, really, but certainly any kind of game design, whether it's turn-based or otherwise.
Yeah, typically the, you know, reducing things down to the essentials is sort of like a hallmark of, or streamlining things or making things elegant is kind of like a hallmark of a more, you know, advanced kind of design sense. But the thing that is being streamlined here is kind of the emphasis on the other person, or on the particular aspect of the other person that you're dealing with. Well, like you're telling me that the game doesn't distract you with anything that isn't about the other player. That it's all just focused on, you know, because chess is like, chess is all about the opponent.
Right.
It's about nothing else. It's not about the designer of the game. It's not about bots, you know, messing around with you as you're, you know, and this is I mean, great games become vehicles for human drama. And it's funny to get back to storytelling. I mean, the reason why people make movies about sports and movies about chess is because those games are so streamlined that this, we don't see the system. We see right through the system, and we see the humanity that embodies that. We see how those game systems are lenses that focus the humanity of the people playing them into laser fine essences or points that then illustrate something about their personality. And again, I'm thinking like as a narrative person, but the way you play chess says something about who you are as a human being. In a way, right? And that's also kind of the drama of sports. That's why we're interested in sports players and their stories of who they are. Because the games are about humans. It's dramatic. It's like a drama of humans. It's some kind of great human story to see humans interacting through this rule system. It's like war narratives are the same thing. It's, you know, so like the way that you would tell a great war story, because it's really the story of a general and how their strategy says something about who they are. And great war stories of great generals are great because within the strategy of how they play the game, who they are revealed. And this is maybe getting a little abstract, but it just seems like the thing about having a game that is so highly focused and is so dependent on the human opponent, so that everything else falls away, it inevitably becomes about engaging with other humans in a very pure, very primal way that is why we've had games throughout the entire history of our species, which makes that kind of game human in a kind of a profound way.
I absolutely agree with you in that. I mean, I have 2 points here. And the first is that in a game involving multiple players, it is the game's role. I mean, no matter whether it's a single player game or with multiple layers, it's still a rule set. But one definition that I have for a single player versus a multiple player game is that in a multiplayer game, it is the game designer's job to sort of set the table and then back off. It's like, here's your setting, but it's the players and the interaction, and as you say, the drama between the players that actually makes the entirety and the worthwhileness of the experience. What I'm curious about is when you were just talking about, well, this is core to games. This is core to the drama and the human struggle that we see in the play of games. When you're saying games there, do you specifically mean games of antagonists, opponents playing against each other? Or would you also apply that to somebody playing through, oh, I don't know, Dark Souls, or even Fallout, or even Pac-Man?
I would say it does apply to both in a kind of technical sense, because the designer, even if you're engaging in a single player game where you're squaring against the design system, really what it is I would argue like a super, 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 super complicated asynchronous game. Because really there is another player who's kind of, or maybe they're not a player, I mean they're a designer, but there is another human.
Yeah.
Right? There is another human that has designed this system, and the way you interact within that system, the way they've designed that system reveals their humanity, and the way you interact with that system reveals yours.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
So I think it does apply, but I think that the thing that makes multiplayer so powerful is not that it's a different thing happening. It's just that the immediacy of that in multiplayer is so much more palpable. And if what you're really looking for is that humanity, you're just going to get it immediately in a multiplayer game, because that's just because the distance is erased.
Yeah, it really is a question of presence and what sort of presence you're dealing with. When you're playing, especially when you're playing a more narrative single-player game, but even in a game, you know, to pull out the Pac-Man example, even in a game like Pac-Man, which doesn't have a story per se, but it definitely is a very clever, can I use the word contrivance? Is that a negative word? I want to say a clever contrivance.
No, it's not a negative word to me.
I'm gonna say that. A very clever contrivance that a designer has put together for your amusement and to give you many interesting decisions to make while you explore this rule set and try not to get eaten by ghosts. In that case, you feel the presence of the designer, but that's kind of in the same way that you feel the presence of Charles Dickens when you read a Dickens novel. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas when you're playing a game with another person, and even if your turns are taking a few days or whatever, you still see with every new piece of information that you get, that is information that is being generated by way of the game system, mind you, but still being generated by another person who is playing at the same time as you and who both of you are thinking about the same thing at the same time. And it is an entirely different experience. I'm not saying it's any better or worse, but the more... Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it just depends on the game. I mean, I think you can have a bad multiplayer game where your relationship with the other person isn't that interesting. And you can have a bad single-player game where your relationship with the designer of the game isn't that interesting.
And I guess the point I want to go to, and the reason I wanted to talk about this today, is I think we're just starting to explore, in specifically the realm of digital games, really fascinating ways that you can play games with other people that are only possible via an intermediary of video games.
Oh, yes, because previously it wasn't possible, or if you were doing it, it would be fundamentally different if you were doing it in a face-to-face way. Well, because you know what's kind of strange about digital games is that the thing that broadband makes possible is the immediacy of a physical sport, but without the physicality, right? Like the other person isn't there. Whereas you could play chess by mail, right? But it was by mail. Whereas now you can do those things instantaneously online. And in the past, there was no way for information between two people who are not in the same place to move that quickly. And now that that's possible, that creates immediacy without physical proximity, which has never been possible in the history of humanity.
That, yes, that is true. I think this also applies to games that you actually play with people who are actually in physical proximity with you, but that are also video games.
So am I right? I mean, it's probably more complicated than this. So it's not just the immediacy and proximity. In the case of somebody who's right in front of you playing a digital game with you, and that digital game doing things that could have never been done before, I would assume that in that case, the special thing is it the codification of the rules in a system that you can't argue with, or is it particularly the way that the digital interface structures the experience, or is it both? Because I've heard in the past people say the thing that makes video games different than regular games is that you can't negotiate the rules, because the rules are not happening in a social contract. They're kind of fundamentally tyrannical. They're enforced by the iron fist of an actual cold, unthinking machine. So there's no such thing as house rules in Demon's Souls. But is it also the interface as well, or is it some third thing that something else you were thinking of? Is it the touch screen on the iPad that makes it like something we could have never done before? Is it like the magic way that screen can change and the way you can touch it?
It's magic. I'm not even
from the perspective of 200 years ago, it's definitely magic.
Oh yeah. Dude. So I'm looking at the iPad is just one particular example. I'm not saying, oh my God, tablets, case closed, right? And there's
that would be a great summary of this podcast. That we would have just said that at the beginning.
Tablets. Oh my God. Good night. You bring up tablets. I happen to have in front of me right now, because I wanted to look at the designer's name. I don't know how to pronounce it either, so it's now my turn to mispronounce somebody's name. But I'm looking at an iPad game called Glitch Tank, which is it's in the App Store. I think it costs $2, maybe it's $3. It's by Michael Brough, Brough, and it is a two player game. One player sits on either side of the iPad lengthwise, and you essentially it's a real-time game where you control a tank. And you have a hand of four cards, which are represented by four buttons in front of you. You play a card by tapping it. Your choices are limited to whatever four random cards are in front of you, and you just...
Wait, this sounds a little bit like it's using the iPad to replicate those games that they used to have at Pizza Hut. Do you know what I mean? Where like you would sit down at a table, but there's literally an arcade machine.
Oh, yes. You're talking about cocktail style machines.
Yes.
I'll link to that from the show notes as well. Before I myself got an iPad, the first time I sat down with my pal, Andy Plotkin, to play a board game, the iPad edition of Small World, the game by... I don't have the designer's name in front of me. It's an adaptation of a game, an actual board game in this case, published by Days of Wonder. It's a fantasy-themed war game. It's a lot of fun. And it was one of the iPad's launch titles, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I sat down and I played that with Andrew Plotkin, the first thing I thought of was cocktail format arcade cabinets. These are the games which were coin-operated video games. You know, they had Pac-Man as this. If you go to Fun Spot, New Hampshire, right by the door, they have the car racing game Rally X in cocktail format.
They do. They have one there?
Yes.
Oh no, you're right. Because in the second floor, they have like three or four of them in a row.
Yeah, it's by the front door. It's next to the Death Rally. It's next to the Death Race 2000 machine.
It's by Crossbow.
Yes, that's right. You remember. And yes, the iPad makes me think of a cocktail cabinet, not just in the fact that, no, I'm going to rewind, exactly because you are sitting across from the other person you're playing with, you are facing each other, but you're interacting over this screen that is on the table in front of you.
You're interacting with this board that's also a game.
Yes, but the sense of...
But it's not a board game.
It is not a board game. You can... Well, as in Glitch Tank's case, you can actually play it turn by turn like a board game if you want, but the real way to play it is just madcap slapping buttons until you manage to blow the other tank up. And it is hilarious. I highly recommend looking at this game. If you're interested in the sorts of multiplayer experiments that I'm interested in, as far as ones that you play with an actual person in the same room as you, this is a great example. And again, this comes back to presence, in that here's another thing you can do with digital games and presence. And in this case, this is meant to be played with another person that you're sitting across with, and you're both laughing. You're both smacking the screen, doing bizarre things with the characters on the screen, because the game gets weirder as you play. The whole conceit of the game and its name, Glitch Tank, is based on the fact that the graphics look like they're on a really dirty Atari cartridge, and they have all these artifacts that keep flickering in and out. There's a button that lets you clone your tank, and a little baby tank pops out. And if you hit that again, then both your tank and your baby tank also get baby tanks. So there's this whole Powers of Two craziness. And if you do that too much, then the copies you make start turning into garbage. And sometimes you get a card that just has garbage on it, and you press it and something weird happens. It's great. But the whole point of the game is you are facing somebody, you're slapping the screen together, and you're laughing like idiots. And it's still a game, mind you. It's not just random silliness. That is an example of, here is an iPad game. It's done digitally. It's not Hero Academy, which is an iPad game that you cannot play with, you know, you can play with someone in the same room if they also happen to have an iPad. But that is a multiplayer video game using the same hardware, but the way you interact with the person is completely different.
So why would that be impossible if it wasn't digital?
What, Glitch Tank?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just wondering, like, is the fact that it's kind of like this automated, animated experience that, like, there's no way that there's no way something that wasn't a machine would be able to structure that experience for players?
The closest analog to that I can think that is analog, haha, is probably like Hungry Hungry Hippos.
Which is a machine.
Yes, but it's not a video game, but it is a system. It is a rule system that is enforced mechanically by, granted, very simple mechanics.
But I thought that but isn't the thing that makes computers the fact that they have software? And that, I mean, the thing that makes a computer and not just a machine, is that it's supposed to be a machine that can do anything, because you just put different software in it. So Hungry Hungry Hippos is like,
it's not Turing complete, is what you're saying.
Philosophically, like, it's not different from a video game. It's just that it's what you would normally do with software, except because it's a physical object, it's been done with hardware. Because it's a machine that's structuring the experience for players who are playing with each other. And it's funny too, because there are a lot of games like that in the 80s, like the 70s and 80s. Like, I remember a lot of games like that. There was Hungry Hungry Hippos, and then there was like Mousetrap, and there were these weird things that they were kind of like not exactly board games. They were just kind of like weird little machine toy game things that had like all sorts of like moving parts and switches and pulleys and things. I mean, they were machines that you got to interact with. I mean, it's funny too, as you mentioned, because I'm just thinking about Hungry Hungry Hippos it's not a very good game, but it is basically a video game. I mean, it's like a physics-based game it's like a physics-based, it's like a bad iPod game.
Yeah, it's got a button.
It's got a button. It's like a one-touch game with a whole bunch of somebody who's just like, oh, hey, physics. I'll put a bunch of balls on the screen, drop in a physics algorithm, and then I'll put a hippo at the bottom. And and go, and that's it. And it's like a flash game from 7 years ago.
Yeah, it may as well be written in Box Judy or something.
Well, no, exactly.
Put some unity around how you're done.
But no, but I'm becoming interested in like we're talking about, like you were talking before about, like, what is the thing that digital is doing that is changing the way, you know, what are computers making possible, right, that was not possible before. And I guess I'm just thinking that, I'm just wondering what that tells us about, is it that it's a computer, or is it that it's a machine, or is there a difference?
So before I started talking about Glitch Tank, you were saying, oh, is it this or is it that? And one question you asked was, is it because it is a, as you said, a draconian enforcer of its rule set? How seriously were you asking that? Because, like, the first thing that thought to mind was, like, oh, I can name a counterexample. Like, you can't bend the rules of tic-tac-toe if I was playing that with you on paper. I mean, you could say, oh, can we just agree that the first move doesn't count, and therefore it's not a video game? But I don't think that's kind of a degenerate case. It's not something...
Well, it could be a degenerate case, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, it depends on...
I guess tic-tac-toe itself is a degenerate.
But this is getting very philosophical. It's kind of like... But it's kind of like the nature of power. I mean, obviously, the thing is that if I want to change the rules of tic-tac-toe, I can. Right? I mean, leaving kind of hacking aside. If I want to change the rules of video games, I actually can't. Right? It's a difference between having power and not having power. I mean, I agree that, like, the game doesn't make sense if you change the rules or break the rules. It's about negotiating between, I mean, it depends on what you believe the game is. Is the game created by the other person that you're playing with? It's like, is the game a machine? Like, who's enforcing the rules? If the rules are enforced upon by social contract, then, you know, social contracts are malleable, right? But machines are immutable. And it's kind of this, it's perhaps a philosophical distinction, but, like, for example, you know, I mean, it's like the difference between, like, it's like the Terminator, right? I mean, it's kind of like you can't argue with a machine.
That is the least interesting reason to me, in that you're saying, well, the advantage of a digital intermediary versus a cardboard tabletop game is that you can't break the rules on a digital one, and therefore that's all it brings.
No. That's not what I'm saying. I'm perhaps getting off track. We don't have to stay on this tangent. The reason I'm bringing this up, though, is because you're right. I don't think, from a design point of view, it's not a huge deal. It's just that in the past, I think maybe my academic media studies hat is kind of creeping in here. It's just that if you're talking about, like, if you're getting, like, seriously philosophical about what is a game and what isn't a game and what is a video game and what isn't a video game, like, when we're talking about essentialism of, like, trying to define these things, I have heard it said that the only meaningful distinction you can draw between digital and non-digital games is the immutability of a machine that enforces rules. Now, that doesn't necessarily have a meaningful... I mean, if you agree to the rules of a social contract, then who cares, right? It's not really all that different. Whether you can't break rules or just don't want to. But it's sort of worth mentioning because it gives us a sense of, like, what the real difference is. I mean, if there is no real essential difference, it does. If that isn't the difference, which is fine, it does beg the question of kind of what the difference is. And I'm just trying to figure that out. Is it, or maybe it's not, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not that interesting.
No, I think that is an interesting challenge you put to me when you say, why can't you play Glitch Tank without a digital system? And there are certainly real-time games that you can play without a digital component. The first thing I think of is Brawl, which is a card game designed by James Ernest. And we're getting kind of loopy here because this is a card game that itself is kind of informed by, you know, the Street Fighter video games, in which you have a character deck. Each player has a deck that represents a fighter character.
Is this a game where you can be Thomas Jefferson?
I don't know. Maybe
I was watching some people play it the other day, and I was interested enough in it that I was kind of like inquiring about the rules. Maybe it's a different game, but I remember there was like a character who was like obviously based on Thomas Jefferson, which I thought was really funny.
It would not surprise me if it's had enough expansion since its initial release, which is like a dozen or more years ago. Yes, you can play as Mr. Jefferson. You play cards, and there's rules about what cards you can play on other cards, and it abstracts a fisticuffs between these two people.
Yeah,
and Glitch Tank is done the same way. But if you want to ask, well, literally, why can't you do this with pieces? Well, the literal answer is it would be impossible, basically, because the cards you're playing are moving these objects around in two-dimensional space and are causing them to do things that humans would not be able to resolve in real time. Like, they're shooting lasers at each other, they're popping out clones of themselves and laying out mines.
The key term there, though, is not in real time, because there's plenty of games where you would resolve those things through like elaborate equations and everybody would just like wait while you calculated them.
Oh yeah, you could play like Car Wars. You could play some Steve, it could be 1981 and we could be in college playing a Steve Jackson game and we could get out our protractors. But normal people haven't played those games in a long number of people never played those games. And there's a good reason for that, because they're horrible and not fun, even if they have a clever idea behind them.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Why aren't they fun? Because they're not real time? This is a good question.
I shouldn't say they're not fun, because clearly, you know, people played them, and I should not generalize. But why are they not fun for most people? Why have I actually bought a Car Wars book at some point in the past and admired it and never actually cut out the little markers and attempted to convince anyone to play it with me? Because the rate at which you play involves reading these rules, setting up a game as well as you can understand given these Baroque rules, and then attempting to maybe play a turn or two after you've cleared out this table, and as soon as one player does something interesting, spend a while looking up to see what happened and if that was in fact legal, and oh well, hang on, my hubcap just fell off, now I have to figure out what angle I was going at and what the torque was and where it should land and if it bounces.
In other words, you're doing all the things that a computer would do instantaneously.
That is correct. In theory, you could play an FPS on a board, right?
Yes,
but you don't.
Some people do. It sounds like you're saying that most people don't.
Most people don't. There is, in fact, another Steve Jackson design called a Frag, which is attempts to be an FPS played on a board.
You know what's funny? I'm looking at Brawl online, and I'm trying to find this character. I'm pretty sure this is the game I saw. But it's funny, too, because I look at Brawl. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for it, and it says, and I scroll down to the bottom, and it says, and the first link is play Brawl on the App Store.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Which is hilarious, because it's like, because it's a card game inspired by a video game, and it is now a digital card game, which is like Street Fighter the game the movie.
Yes.
Or no, Street Fighter the movie the game. Because you remember there was a Street Fighter game, then a Street Fighter movie, and then a game based on the movie that was based on the movie and not on the game.
It had a full motion video intro. It's very impressive.
Yes. So, I mean, this is kind of fascinating. So, like, there's clearly a value in a digital version of a game where the entire draw of it is that it was non-digital.
The other, you know, major example that I have that is specific to games you play with people who are immediately present is Johann Sebastian Joust.
Oh, yes. Oh, and I've played that game.
I think there's a video of you playing this game.
Have you seen the video?
If I understand correctly.
Have you seen the video where we play that game starting at, I think we start at South Station and we get off at Central and the battle rages all the way across Boston in the subway?
Yeah, yeah. You guys are like, Errol, I want to say you're Errol Flynning it up, but I've already lost that.
No,
what I mean
is,
to say is there's a lot of like, buckles being swashed up and down the red line among all these civilians.
Yeah, there's like people there, and I don't know how well it comes across in the video, but there were there are some people in the video who are I mean, I was there and I remember some people being kind of horrified, like they were terrified of what we were doing. And then there were some people who were just like, this is so awesome. Like there was somebody there who was like asking me like what we were playing and like where he can buy it. So yeah, there was like various reactions. But yeah, Johann Sebastian Joust is awesome. And it's true. I mean, it's a game that, I mean, is only really possible. Well, it's funny. I mean, you could play it and just kind of be on your honor to follow the rules. But the fact that so I'm coming back to this point. The fact that the computer system is kind of dictating the rules. Because you know why games like that don't work when kids play them? You know why they break down? It's the whole, I shot you, no you didn't.
You're just talking about like freeform backyard games?
Yeah.
Like, kids play?
Exactly. And that's what Johann Sebastian Joust is. It's like a freeform backyard game, except it's actually enforced by a computer system that actually forces everybody to be honest.
Right. Okay. Well, and this is okay. So this is the positive side of what you're saying. Your question earlier about is what a digital intermediary brings to the table primarily just its ability to perfectly enforce rules.
Well,
and I don't think it's only that, but
no, it's definitely not only that. I definitely don't want to give the impression that it's only that. But in the case of that particular game, I think you really see the value of that because you need no referee. Because nobody can argue with the computer system.
I guess I'd say in the case of kids playing in their backyard, they're not. I mean, when you're just playing, gunfight with your friends, maybe you played it differently than I did, but we didn't actually have a rule set per se. We just said, if I go pew and I see you, then you're dead, and that was pretty much the whole game. You have to fall down.
No. I think you. I mean, Pew is not the greatest example. I just named that
game. Is
that
the name of the game? It's Pew.
That's the name of the game.
I like it.
Pew is not the best example, but I guess I'm thinking of. But it's funny because Johann Sebastian Joust captures a lot of the feeling of that kind of play. Except it's highly structured with this immutable rule system.
Yes.
And. I mean, guns are not a great example, but it is a little bit like when kids sort of are pretend sword fighting. And like, for example, I had Nerf fencing when I was a kid.
You say that was like an event you were driven to? Like, oh, I can't come over. I have Nerf fencing.
No.
It's like piano.
No. Okay. But like,
that'd be rad.
I love sword fighting. But I really wanted like a really good kind of sword fighting game that would kind of capture a lot of the kind of like kind of drama and kind of emotion and thrill and suspense and you know whatever of the kind of like of fencing or at least the kind of imaginary fencing I saw in movies. I wanted it to feel like, you know, the great part of a Princess Bride, which is not real fencing, but, and I had this Nerf fencing and I remember that it was never really, you know, I mean, like, how do you judge whether or not you delivered a fatal blow to the other person?
Right.
Like you just hit them really hard or, you know what I mean? I mean, you would sort of work with like water balloons, like maybe you got them wet, but people would always, you know, break the rules and say like, I'm going to throw this at you anyway. And it's just the thing about Joust is that it's like after my entire life, it's like, it's what I wanted that to be. and it's because somebody found a use for this totally stupid, you know, Move controller that doesn't really work, but it's like completely awesome for this game.
Is it worth describing really quick what this is?
Yeah, it's basically everybody has a Move. Well, and I want to point out, like, what about the digital aspect of this experience makes it work? Because it would not be the same without it. Is that basically everybody has a Move controller.
Now, by Move controller, you mean it's a PlayStation 3 controller.
It's a PlayStation 3 Move controller.
Yeah.
Which was put to awful use in games like Heavy Rain. But it's basically this thing, which is like a stick with like a light with a ball on the end, and the ball can change color. And these things are hooked into a computer. And the computer plays music, and the music goes, if the music is going, well, okay, basically the light is on, and so there's a bunch of people playing, and and the light at the end of the controller is on, and if the lights are on, that means everybody is playing. And when all the lights turn on, which has this really awesome, and this is a really important part of the game, it has this really awesome, like, lightsaber turning on sound. Like, yeah. Everybody, it's funny, too, because it's a behavioral thing. Nothing forces you to hold your hand up in the air when you turn it on, and then it goes, and then the light turns on. Everybody does it because it's fucking awesome.
Now, this is not an integral part of the controller. That's a sound effect that's being sent to the controller from the computer running the game.
I think so. I might be wrong.
Okay. I see. This is the only time I've ever seen PlayStation Move controllers being used for any purpose ever. So, yeah, that sound effect is tied to JS Joust for me.
Well, yeah, definitely. So it has this awesome. It's like it sounds like a lightsaber, or it's like the Ghostbusters backpack turning on. Like, it's really cool. And it gives you this awesome feeling of like, oh, the power is I've turned on the power, right? And then everybody does that, and then basically this music plays, and the idea is that the speed at which the music is playing determines the speed at which the controller can move without tripping itself. And when the controller moves too fast, it trips a switch and it kind of goes, it releases this other sound, like, and then the light shuts off. And that means you're dead for that round, but that means you've lost. So it's essentially a game. It's like if you've ever played a game where, like, everybody has a cup of water that's full and you're trying to, like, knock the water out. You're trying to get the other person to spill the water. Hmm. It's essentially that, except it's aided digitally by these controllers. And it has this really great kind of sound design and visual design with the way the controllers light up and the way the sound works.
It's also interestingly literally digital in that the light is either on or off. So there's no question about whether you're still playing or not.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody knows when they lost. Nobody says, "Hey, I'm still in the game," because if the light's off, you're done, you know. And there's something about the way that structures the experience that really makes that game kind of taut and wonderful. And also tactile. And kind of strangely futuristic. It kind of taps into this kind of cultural imaginary of like post Star Wars, like lightsabers, in a very kind of abstract way. But I think there is something that's part of the kind of cool aesthetic of the game, and also like the musical part of it is really well realized. So, because it encourages you to kind of speed up and slow down, which is a little bit like level design, and of course the spaces you play it in are like level design. You'll notice I'm such a fan of stealth in the video. When I'm playing it, I'm employing stealth at one point, which nobody else ever does. It doesn't really help me all that much. All it means is I get killed later.
Yeah, it also doesn't help you because I can't remember if it was you or somebody else. I want to say like Dean, who's filming it, points at you and goes, "He's using stealth! It's stealth!" Because that was your thing at PAX, because this was filmed coming home from PAX, where you had given a talk on stealth games.
I was the moderator of a talk on stealth games, yeah. So, but this was, I mean, Joust is pretty wonderful, but it's a... I guess going back to the topic, it is definitely an example of a digital experience that is absolutely, essentially, deeply human and rooted in the real world and rooted in direct physical relationships with other people. And, I mean, it feels like a computer-aided sport.
Yeah, and I like also how you said that it seemed like the realization, finally, after all these years of Nerf swords done correctly, and that this is how I feel now about where digital multiplayer is going in general. And there's so many brilliant designers, both independent ones. Like, who's the designer of this game? I have the webpage up, and the organization name is Die Gute Fabrik, but that's not a person's name.
Oh, wait, which game?
J.S. Joust.
Oh, Doug Wilson?
Okay.
I think.
I'm willing to believe that. Why did I end up here? It says, it's the first place I went to. You know, it's not on Wikipedia. Wikipedia has an article about every little pissant app store game, and it doesn't have this. Why is that? It's got all these, like, Sundance Awards laurels on its homepage, except they're not actually Sundance Awards. Douglas Wilson, is that what you said?
Yes, Doug Wilson.
2011 Nordic Game Jam. Cool.
Yep.
The original version used Wiimotes. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's actually embarrassing that I paused on the name, because I know him. He stayed at our house during PAX.
This most recent one?
Yeah. Yeah, oh. he was coming home with us.
Oh, is he demonstrating it at the show? Because that's where I saw the game for the first time.
Yeah.
One of of the two or three things that were totally awesome about PAX East for me this year, one of them was walking, like, getting a tweet from somebody like, hey, there's J.S. Joust in this room, and walking towards the room and seeing that there was a big circle of people playing this game in the hallway outside of the room. So it's just like a guerrilla setup, not scheduled or anything. And this blob of game just continued to go on for several hours, at least a couple of hours. I was not there the whole time, but it was fantastic. I played it several times. It reminded me of Werewolf that you see at other conventions, at board game conventions or puzzler conventions, which, again, off topic, but just a social event that is very well tuned to the event going on around it. In this case, a video game convention.
Oh, yeah.
This is a good show. What do you think? I really like it.
Oh no, I agree. I mean, I think that it was like I was actually worried that. Well, I wasn't worried, but I wasn't sure. I mean, I guess I just wasn't quite sure where it would go. But I realized that J.S. Joust is for me kind of like what relating back to the Nerf swords, like what Hero Academy is for you, going back to MUDs.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like, it just sounds like that's what you were saying, which is kind of funny, because going into this, I hadn't even thought about J.S. Joust, but I think, I mean, it's exactly, that is a game I've played.
Oh,
It is a game I love, and I think it's wonderful. So I think we have had kind of the same experience on this topic. I hadn't quite realized it.
No, Hero Cat, to me, in my mind, Hero Academy and J.S. Joust and Glitch Tank and other games I could mention, but for lack of time, are very tightly bound in my mind because they are all examples of games designed by people who clearly love to play games with other people and want to see what they can do in the realm of, you know, pretty much in all these cases, mobile digital technology with and make something awesome that could not have existed before this hardware existed.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that it's interesting because if you look at kind of these two strands of design, right, when you say mobile, you know, these games that are using these new interfaces like the Wii or the Wii U or, you know, the Move or the Kinect or all these kinds of things, they're about kind of transforming the living room into this space where you're more involved with the other people you're playing with. But mobile games allow you to make the fact that you're seeing different people throughout the day, an experience that you're activating for potential gaming relationships. And it is true. It is about trying to reconnect players. Cause I think that it's funny too, cause I know that there's some people who are just like, no, you know, single player games are a total aberration, and in the future everything will be multiplayer.
Are people actually like that? Who are these people that you're talking about?
Raph Koster has said that.
Huh.
Well, okay, I don't want to mischaracterize him. I don't want to misquote him. He has, in my opinion, said as much. Although I think he was being deliberately,
provocative.
Provocative, yeah. He's a smart guy. I think he was being deliberately provocative, and I don't think he said that. I think that's like
historically speaking, single player games are indeed an aberration. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was saying more just that multiplayer games or games that have multiplayer games that have. He basically said in the future, games, it's going to be impossible for games to exist apart from other people. Whether it's achievements or even if it's a single player game and you're just comparing your achievement score with other players, and I think achievements are totally fucked up. That thought kind of horrifies me, but in general, he's just saying that, you know, technology is becoming so connected. Some days I may feel like a single player game. Some days I may feel like a more kind of immediate experience with another player. But
that's a syntactic quibble, though.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess what I'm saying though is that I don't think that single player games. I think that there's room for all kinds of games, and I think digital technology is sort of, because in the past digital technology has been kind of better suited to kind of a certain set of constraints in terms of game design, perhaps, at least before broadband and at least before the current kind of mobile. You know, it was easy to have this kind of rise of kind of single player. But now that we don't have those constraints anymore, I think that there's kind of a flood of kind of like what games have always been in a more immediate face-to-face sense, kind of flooding back, and I think that's good. And I think that you know, computers have given us the ability to see, you know, that perhaps an asynchronous automated single-player experience where it's just you versus another human designer itself is a kind of interesting thing that can be perfectly awesome on its own. And also multiplayer games that you play with other people using digital technology is also an awesome thing that is, you know, that is made possible. I mean, it doesn't have to be one or the other. I mean, the new technology makes both those things possible, and we can explore both those kinds of richness. And it just depends on which game, you know, and I think now we have these makers of games who are interested in these things. Cause I mean, like, and I know that, you know, Doug Wilson he's all about human interaction. Like everything he does is about humans interacting with each other in kind of very immediate ways. But that doesn't mean that that's what all games have to be, although I'm absolutely delighted that he is really pushing for that. And I think we need more of that, but I don't think we, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think the thing that's awesome about this is the breadth and the variety. And I think as long as we can stay away from, you know, these kind of like singular utopian or dystopian, depending on your perspective, proclamations that in the future, all games will be blah, you know.
Well, there's no real point to that because I think people are going to make the games they want to make, and people are going to play the games that are worth playing, and games are going to continue to evolve.
Well, because they always have.
Yeah.
I think probably the most interesting thing from my perspective in terms of the new technology is how it is introducing new people to these kinds of games. One of the reasons I'm kind of partial to single player games is because I grew up in a particular environment at a particular time. Like we were talking before about our upbringing.
Yeah, same here. I think that's true for both of us.
Yeah, and how it shaped us. But it's funny too, because it's like if we can grow up primarily as single player players and then kind of like discover multiplayer later, the reverse could also conceivably happen, where somebody grows up playing, you know, playing only Hero Academy, right? and then like 20 years later, they play, you know, some completely awesome single player game, like heavy narrative single player game for the first time, just like your brother, who's just kind of, and they have the same kind of thing of like, there's games where people talk to each other and have adventures, and yep. they get to discover those things. And it's just a cultural exchange at that point.
This was Play of the Light, a conversation about video games featuring Matthew Weiss and me, Jason McIntosh. The show is produced and edited by me. Visit playofthelight.com to subscribe via iTunes, read show notes, and see other goodies. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.
If only there was a way to play Hero Academy on a board.
No, that's asking too much, I'm afraid. I'll play you Hungry Hungry Hippos anytime you want, though. I'm ready to throw down.
All right. God, do they make that game anymore?
Yeah.
Really?
Dude. I'll bring it over sometime.
Really? Because that's interesting. It's fascinating they still make that.
I think they have to.
What's the, is there a real demand for that?
Board game.
You know, are kids today like, man, I've been playing Hero Academy for 6 months, but oh, Hungry Hungry Hippos. Thanks, Mom. You know, or.
It's got marbles and buttons and it's really, really loud and annoys Mom and Dad. How can you not like it? Not like it. Hungry, looking at Amazon now. Hippos.
I'm looking at Hungry Hungry Hippos.
It's on sale, $19.89. It's $3 off if you get it by July 23rd. Hasbro, 3 stars. There you go.
That's right, 3 stars. What do the customer reviews say?
It's kind of like parts you can swallow. That's dangerous. Oh, warning, awesome. Choking hazard. It's all over
the place. Mine says this is awesome, most helpful positive review. Awesome game, my nephew loves it.
There you go.
And then the most helpful negative review is, if you and your little one can deal with it. I used to love this game when I was a kid.
Yeah, a lot of people are complaining about the shoddy construction now, and it's a lot flimsier now. And
Really?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. And the first thing I'm like, well, you're a grown up, and you have giant ham hands, and you're smashing it. You're not a kid anymore. You have to use kid gloves with these things. The hippos. I like the green one. I think they have names. I don't know if they are. No, they have little names on a sticker that you put in. It's like a Henry Hippo is like the...
Oh my god, I don't remember that. No, look at all this, they got characters.
Yeah, yeah.
This has become like a transmedia universe.